Richard, welcome onto the sound test. Thank you so much for agreeing to this conversation.
Thanks, Lee. Great to see you and great to be on board.
It's one I've been looking forward to for a while because I kind of wanted to dial back quite a bit with my questions at the very beginning. I've got all sorts of things on Jet Set Radio and Headhunter and definitely James Bond because I'm a big James Bond fan myself. But I was really taken aback going through your career and interviews and stuff in the past about just how broad it is, how much you've done and how much it really goes back to childhood and even back through your teenage years, you were playing around being a DJ and things like that. So I think I wanted my first question to be what it was actually like to grow up in a musical family like that. Were your parents working musicians or just fans that had instruments around the place?
Yeah, well, yeah, so my parents were both music teachers. My mum taught the piano and the violin. My dad taught the piano and composition, and he taught at a girls' high school. So there was always music going on around the house, and my sister played viola and saxophone. So there was a piano in the front room, piano in the lounge. So I was sort of grew up around that, hearing music all the time, hearing my dad kind of write at the piano every Sunday morning and hearing various students coming through the door practicing their pieces and doing their sight reading and stuff. And then in my bedroom as a kid, I sort of started getting into home computers and stuff like that. So I had a ZX Spectrum for my 11th birthday, and I was doing various bits of music making on that with there was a few applications, one called Spectrum, which I used to use, which was a drum machine, and then something else called the RAM Music Machine, which was kind of a very basic sampler and sequencer. So I was using that as well, and then I moved on to the Atari ST when I was like 13, 14, and got into sort of proper sequencing and built up a small collection of synths and things like that, and gaming at the same time, of course.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that actually, because you've mentioned a few times like being a big gamer yourself, and there was one interview where you mentioned having a home computer when you were 11, and if I've done my Wikipedia maths right, this was like 1984, 1983 or something like this. So I was thinking it must be a Spectrum or a C64 or something like that. So like how much did that inform then your composition going forward, like maybe particularly some of your more electronic stuff like Jet Set Radio or some of the electronic elements of Headhunter and stuff like that as well?
Yeah, I think everything had an impact on the way I write now and the kind of music I write and the way I produce. Certainly the Spectrum, I was able to learn a bit of basic music programming. So, you know, way back in the day, I had a QuickShot 2 joystick, and I used to make different arpeggios on each axis of the joystick and things like that. Just messing around, getting sound out of it. Same with the Atari, and same with some basic synths that I had at the time. So I was kind of really experimenting right from a very early age, whilst I was also gaming as well, and sort of, you know, informing myself not only with the technical side and the electronic side, but at the same time, I was also learning the trombone, which was my major instrument, playing in orchestras as well. And this was, you know, like you said, early to mid 80s. So this was the sort of really the explosion of hip hop in the UK. So I was listening to Public Enemy and etc. at the same time, and getting into the kind of music that I like listening to for pleasure. So all those kind of three things really came together and sort of helped form my writing style.
Mm-hmm. And that was something I noted as well. It's not like so many broad things that you've worked on. I've noticed what a broad taste you've got as well. And since you mentioned the trombone, one question I had was how much you feel like that being your main instrument early on influenced you as well, because I bring this up in a lot of my interviews to connect, because I'm a musician myself. I'm a bass player, and awesome. I've found that's influenced me big time with pretty much everything that I come to compose or listen to even. And I noticed that you're a big fan of funk and things like that, and even like coming down to James Bond, which is very brass heavy. Wondered if you could talk a little bit about the effect of brass.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be more than happy to. My favourite subject. So growing up as a trombone player, obviously in the orchestra, the majority of the repertoire for trombone is more 20th century, just because of the when the trombone came about, really. So, you know, you don't really find trombones in really old classical and chamber music. So it's a lot of 20th century symphonies especially that I was playing. So my favorite composer is Stravinsky, and specifically the Firebird Suite, which I was playing in first trombone in when I was about 13, 14. And then all of the sort of big Russian symphonic composers, Prokofiev, Mahler, Rimsky-Korsakov, etc. So that was one strand of my learning on trombone, playing these sort of big symphonies where the brass section get quite often quite big, loud, brash melodies and etc. And effects and things like that. So that was one side of it. And then, of course, I sort of discovered sort of jazz and funk and those kind of styles through growing up with early hip hop, who were of course sampling old James Brown records, etc. And that's where I sort of delved back into the 70s, which was even before I was born. So I was actually, you know, digging into James Brown and finding all these other amazing kind of funk bands and artists from the early 70s. And then I started playing trombone in big bands when I was about 15, 16. I was in the National Youth Jazz Orchestra here in the UK. So I was learning that repertoire as well. And so, like you rightly said, put that together for James Bond, for the soundtrack for Bloodstone, which is, you know, stylistically, it's kind of a mixture of symphonic writing and jazz writing. And that's what John Barry really mastered. And I think that's what gives the essence of a Bond score, in my opinion. So hopefully I was well versed in being able to do that, having that kind of background.
100%. And I really am actually an unashamed Bond fan. And this is good timing, because I actually just had a bit of a marathon of all the movies just a couple of months ago. So it's very fresh in my mind. I've 100% got questions about that, but to stay in a kind of like moving through time kind of thing, leading into Headhunter, I was interested because it's quite early in your career, and yet straight away, well, you're in Abbey Road and working with top players and top engineers and things like that. I mean, again, I want to dig into this, but I was intrigued in, you can't just step into that in the kind of things you were doing throughout education and your life leading into that, that was giving you experience in this before just like stepping foot into Abbey Road. So what were some of those experiences? I think you mentioned like playing in a big band yourself, for example.
Yeah, I mean, my studies were primarily classical music training. So, you know, I'd been learning about orchestration and playing in orchestras since I was kind of 11, 12 years old, really. So that orchestral, that symphonic background was really just growing throughout my teens, really. And having studied, you know, doing my music A-level GCSE and then a honours degree in music, it was a very solid classical foundation. I was just able to add various elements of the things I've been listening to in my spare time for pleasure, and the sort of electronic elements that I'd been messing around with in my home studio at the time as well. So when Headhunter came about, I mean, I'd been dying to kind of get my hands on a full orchestral score, you know, forever, really. And it's just a question that at Sega I was being asked to write all different kinds of styles. And then when this game came about, the director of the game, John Crockness, he said he wanted a really kind of Hollywood cinematic type score. And I said, absolutely, I can deliver that for you. And, you know, there are some electronic elements as well. Kind of around that time, going back to Bond as well, there's some influences from those Bond films around that time where they're introducing more electronic elements and drum loops and things like that. So it fitted very well in my style, and I was sort of chomping at the bit, ready to get going. And so how Abbey Road came about, I just presented a budget and said, this is how you do it, these are the people we need, these are the players, the engineers, the copyists, conductors, etc. And presented that, and got the budget signed off, and yeah, worked really hard on the score, and then we recorded in January 2001.
And what's it like working with a team like that as well? Like from the players to the engineers and everything?
Oh, it's just incredible. I mean, the musicians really bring a score to life. You know, I know we've got great tools at our disposal now with samples and things like that, but there's nothing like a real musician. They just bring a score to life and put their own humanity and musicality and emotion into a soundtrack. So it's, you know, it was a pleasure to be able to work with them. And they'd never played on a video game before, and this one was actually the first video game to be recorded at Abbey Road. So there was a lot of interest in what we were doing, both from the staff at Abbey Road, you know, the engineers, and for some of the wider sort of gaming press and music press alike. I think they still thought games was quite inferior in terms of quality, both in terms of the writing of the music and the production and delivery of the music in those days. But they were certainly interested in what we were doing. And the musicians really, really loved it. And we had a great team, came out with a great result. And the people really took notice, and it sort of set me on my way to what I'm doing now.
And there are some electronic elements in there as well, like with some percussion, and I'm not sure about the bass as well. I'm not sure with some of the bass and Jack's theme.
Yeah, there's quite a few synth basses as well in there. I didn't want to go too heavy on the electronics because we have the whole orchestra as well, and it might have been a bit overkill, but there are certain points, especially in some of the stealthy type cues, there are some synth basses in there, and as you said, Jack's theme, and then we've got some drum loops and some electronic percussion as well.
Mm-hmm. And is that easy enough to incorporate with an orchestra? Are we just talking about backing tracks and things like that?
Yeah, you have to think about it when you're doing the writing, because if you've got a big synth bass, you don't want to take over the entire range of the double basses or the tuba or some of the low woodwind. So you use it in a sparing way, but then you orchestrate with the rest of the orchestra, with the orchestra and the players sort of sparingly, and taking that into account so you don't create a sort of muddy mess. But everything has its specific role and is in its specific frequency range so that everything gels together well. So you do have to think about it consciously. You can't just throw it all together, but I was already thinking about that while I was writing the score and orchestrating it as I went along.
And the production side of things as well, like as in, and this is leading into Jet Set Radio a little bit, beats and breaks and producing in that kind of way. Is that something that you were more educating yourself with for fun and on the side and with friends and such, rather than part of your official education?
Definitely. I mean, I had no real formal education in music technology apart from one module I took at my university. So all throughout my teens, it's all completely self-taught. It's reading magazines, talking to friends that were doing a similar thing, playing in bands, DJing, those kind of things. It was kind of self-taught, you know, sampling and sequencing. That was completely self-taught. There was no music technology GCSE or A level or any formal qualifications back in those days. It was just, as I said, a small module as part of my music degree, which I took when I was in my third year. A lot of kind of just keen interest, finding out things. You know, this is pre-internet, so it was reading Sound on Sound magazine and those kind of things. And, you know, people at my school and other schools that had a couple of synths and were making music, we used to kind of get together and just play music or create new music together and things like that. So it's a real interesting journey, and completely self-taught, and just really enjoyed the experience of finding out and breaking things and fixing things and experimenting. And fantastic time.
So Jet Set Radio was a perfect project for you in that regard. But also, one thing I picked up on in a previous interview with you, and it's a non-musical question, but I think it's too relevant not to bring up, is whether you could talk a little bit about your experiences with street art, which you've mentioned that you've actually had in the past, which is really interesting to me, how that all dovetails together with the game itself.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, it's due to the kind of time I grew up, I guess. I grew up not in London, but not far from London in the home counties. And as I said, this huge explosion of hip-hop coming across from the US in, it would have been about 85 onwards, I would have thought, 84, 85 onwards. And Def Jam Records, which was a huge record label of early hip-hop artists, they had a tour in London and brought about five or six of their major artists. So people like, off the top of my head, LL Cool J, Run-DMC, Public Enemy, and I was exposed to all this amazing music that I really, really, you know, I just enjoyed the rhythms, the tempo. Some of the rap lyrics were really sort of resonating with a kid kind of growing up when you're, you know, finding your own identity and things like that. Funny enough, I saw Public Enemy just 3 weeks ago, so I'm still a big fan.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, it was all those kind of influences kind of mixed together, really. And you know, street art and the sort of clothing style all came part of that sort of early hip-hop culture while it was establishing itself in the UK. And of course now there's so many subgenres and it's gone on to be such a huge sort of musical movement in its own right. But street art is something I'd always appreciated. Certainly the more high-end, not necessarily the tagging side was never really my thing, but some of the very talented artists I've always admired. You know, going back to the original film with breakdance and those kind of movies that were around when I was a kid, and you know, just seeing some of that artwork was really inspiring.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've mentioned before getting a relatively small amount of direction for the Jet Set Games, and I was interested in how much you felt like that came from a trust in you, because you had already worked on several Sega titles by that point, or how much that might have came from a general creative attitude that was going around the production of that game, because I do feel like it permeates Jet Set Radio, just creativity.
I mean, it's a good question. I think the answer, and I definitely need to give credit to Deki Naganuma, who was already working on the game, and he sent me a CD with about six tracks on, and if I remember correctly, the producer in Japan from the game team spoke to my producer in Sega Europe at the time and said, oh, can we get Richard to write a track? And that was kind of it, really. I was listening to what Naganuma-san was doing. I totally got it, you know, immediately, totally got it and completely loved it. I thought he was creating some great tracks, and I just knew what to do. And, you know, I had some screenshots of the game. I think I had a playable build as well. I listened to what Naganuma-san was doing and I just knew exactly what I wanted to do and just got on and did it, really. It's simple as that. I had no real feedback, no submission process. I just wrote the track and sent it off and they put it straight in the game. So that was lucky.
And it all comes together absolutely amazingly. It's such a fantastic soundtrack. It truly is. I mean, I played Jet Set Radio for all of about a month when it originally came out, because I never had a Dreamcast. I played it with a friend for about a month.
Yeah.
It's stuck in my head for years and years and years. And knowing that we were going to get this interview out, I've been playing it again. And
it's an amazing game. I remember when we had a build into the office from Sega Japan, and you know, everyone was crowding around. No one could believe their eyes about this such unique art style and incorporating street culture and, you know, rollerblading. I mean, I used to play street hockey when I was a kid, and so I got that side of it as well. So yeah, it really had every ingredient that I understood in it. And yeah, I mean, even to this day, it still stands the test of time without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. And you've mentioned previously not being involved in the choice of the licensed tracks, with the exception of, I think you've mentioned three for a localization. Do you remember That's which correct. Of those they were and the process of choosing them? Because I imagine that it wasn't just plucked out of the air.
No, not at all. Well, it's really credit to a good friend of mine, Russell Kerrison, who at the time was one of the producers at Sega Europe. And him and I go way back as friends, and he got me sort of into DJing. I've actually got his turntables in my studio right now. But our sort of shared love of music and hip hop, and he got me into more of the break scene, which was really big in, I guess, the 90s. And when Jet Set came in for localization, we were having a discussion within the Sega Europe offices about the licensed track that Sega America put in, because they sort of personalized it a bit for the US market and the North American market. And we felt we wanted to change a couple of the tracks which we felt weren't particularly going to work for a European audience.
They had Rob Zombie, right? And as a Brit, I can agree it wouldn't quite resonate over here.
Yeah, that you know, as great a track that is, I didn't personally feel that as a particularly good fit for the game. And I've never really believed in licensing for the sake of licensing unless it adds something to it. So I had a discussion with my friend and colleague Russell, and then with the producer in Sega Europe and the marketing department, And we came up with these three tracks, which are, you know, very obscure and no one would really know them, and they're not by particularly famous bands, but they just work absolutely perfectly for the soundtrack. So we had, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, Recipe for the Perfect Afro, Funky Pluckers, and I forget what the third track was. You'll have to correct me, I've got the CD in the other room, but they were chosen specifically for the European release of the first Jet Set Radio.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you mentioned it briefly. My next question was going to be tied into that about the extent to how much you embrace licensed tracks, and you... You alluded to it, and this is going to make me jump well ahead to some questions about Guardians of the Galaxy, because that utilizes a lot of licensed music. I think it utilizes it very well. So I think if you could talk a little bit about maybe examples of when it's been used just for the sake of it, and examples when it has been used well, or maybe your experiences of incorporating it into Guardians of the Galaxy, although I know someone was involved in that as well.
Yeah, so... It's a bit above my pay grade, because that's normally down to a music supervisor, and there are a number of reasons why tracks are licensed into games. Sometimes it can be purely marketing, sometimes it can be purely because of the particular song or the particular artist. I always think about things, you know, being a composer, I think about things in terms of mood and vibe and what it's going to lend to the game. So I'm not necessarily thinking with a marketing brain on, because I'm not a marketing executive. So there are lots of different reasons why we get licensed soundtracks in. I mean, you know, the first big success, in my opinion, was of course Wipeout, which was, in my opinion, chose specifically because of those tracks, and it works so well with the game. I'm not a fan of shoehorning, you know, licensed tracks into a game for the sake of it, unless it adds something to it, like I've said. Whereas Guardians, now I'll say this, I had no input in the licensing of those tracks at all, although I absolutely loved every single choice that was made. The credit goes to Steve Jurkowski, who's the senior audio director at Eidos Montreal, who was the audio director of the project, and also a good mutual friend of ours, Randy Eckhart, who does a lot of licensing and used to work at a lot of the major record labels in the US. So they had this kind of huge list, and they got pretty much everything they wanted. And I think the choices they made about that, it puts the player right back in that kind of era. And that was what they wanted to achieve. And they've got some absolutely legendary songs. And, you know, I think it's hilarious listening to my score back to back with those tracks. And the one thing we did in Guardians, and I did, specifically, was to make sure that the score blended seamlessly into the licensed tracks. So for example, there's a level where you're in Peter Quill's house, a flashback to when he was a kid, and the song that's playing is Everyone Wants to Rule the World, Tears for Fears, and you hear it on the radio, and then that kind of fades out and my score comes in, but it comes in exactly the same key and the same tempo, and I echo the melody of that song in the French horns on the intro to that cutscene. So a lot of care was taken to deliver that sort of seamless experience. But yeah, I thought they did an amazing job on the licensing.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I was going to ask about exactly that, about how close you worked with the licensing and how much you might have incorporated into the music. So that's great to hear. And I particularly love that song as well. That's so good.
Yeah, me too.
But to jump back to Jet Set Radio then, Jet Set Radio Future, which very similar game in many ways, but there are some definite differences. And one of them for me is a little bit of extra darkness, a little bit of extra future for sure. Probably being the key word for the whole game. So what about the future, this awesome track of yours that's like takes a slightly different tack deliberately, I think, to some of your other tracks, and is sort of you've mentioned thinking about future music and what might have been in the future. And this was interesting to me, because I've spoken about it before. I think Grand Theft Auto 2, which was released at a similar time, was set like a month in the future or something about that, like that. Something weird, like it's just a month in the future. And I remember speaking to the composer about imagining music from a month in the future. If you could talk a little bit about the kind of things you had in mind for that track.
Absolutely. It's quite a funny story, actually, because this came up recently. I was recording at Abbey Road back in a couple of months ago in May for another non-game related project, and I was chatting to one of the guys there, and we got talking about game soundtracks and that particular track, What About the Future, and he knew the track very well, and we were sort of going back to the origins of where it came from. Now we're going back to 2001, I believe. So Jet Set Radio, I was just finishing off as I was writing Headhunter, and then as soon as Headhunter was finished and mixed and in the game, I went straight onto Jet Set Radio Future. It was a conscious decision, you're absolutely right, that I wanted to do something a bit dark and a bit more futuristic, because when I was looking at the in-game levels, that's kind of what spoke to me from looking at the game itself, is that it was more futuristic and it was darker than the first game, and I wanted to represent that with the music. So at the time, you know, like I mentioned, the break scene was really, really big in the UK, and just sort of underground at that point. And I was clubbing around various places in central London and in South London. And there used to be this place in South London called the Buddha Lounge, and I used to go there with some friends quite a lot and listen to all these kind of new underground tracks. So I think a lot of that formed my sort of style for that track. You know, they were a lot darker. All the stuff I was listening to was very high energy, but quite dark in the material. So the breaks themselves were quite fast, sort of around 130, 135 BPM, quite heavy. But then the bass lines and the sort of pads and the synths used were quite dark, which then appealed to me both going to those clubs, and then when I saw this game, I thought, yeah, I can utilise some of that. So I kind of messed around with some beats, programmed off some beats, and then added the rest in, and it sort of came about like that. But yeah, it was a conscious decision to sort of go a little bit darker for that track.
And one thing I thought was like actually really interesting about it, if you're thinking about it as something sort of futuristic, and it does sound that way, is you've talked about using analog drum machines on it and analog synths, as opposed to like the use of samples and stuff, which we might be more likely to hear on something like Bok Fresh or Everybody Jump Around. This was just an interesting side point to me, that it's like using older equipment to get a futuristic sound. It's kind of intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, so the vocoded voice, so that's me shouting Jet Set Radio Future, and I forget what the other song was, but I sort of made those up, and I have an analog vocoder, which, I mean, the software ones are pretty good now, to be honest, but in those days the analog ones were a lot better. But yeah, you can sort of tweak the settings to get quite a gritty, visceral sound out of it, which I thought was kind of more futuristic. Back in these days, we're talking 25 years ago now or thereabouts, and the software synths were just kind of getting started. They weren't really that great. They all sounded a bit the same. They didn't have that kind of aggression that I was looking for. So a lot of my analog stuff, for example, I think on that track there's a bit of original Roland TB-303 bass line, which is heavily distorted as well. You wouldn't really get a soft synth or a software plugin to sound like that in 2001. So, I sort of relied on that stuff to make sounds that I thought were futuristic, in the sense that they were not particularly well known or you know, they hadn't been incorporating lots of kind of pop tracks and things like that. Yes, on the underground dance scene, for sure. If people were into that, they would have kind of heard those kind of similar sounds around that time. But that was something I wanted to try and create. And actually, a lot of the sounds I made first before writing the track, I was just sort of messing around, creating some sounds and, you know, like I said, messing around with some beats and getting a feel for it, and then sort of constructed the track from there. And it was a conscious decision to have a sort of that main drop about a third of the way through, where you get this kind of dark intro and then the track drops. And that was definitely something I thought would work well with the game.
I was going to say, and this is just a total tangent, there is one thing I particularly love about that track, and I think it's one of the things that makes it what it is like this really quite ominous held synth chord that just holds there in the background. Yeah, I feel like that's a big part of the future feel for me. It's almost like more introspective and cynical than the playful sound.
Yeah, I mean, that that sound is a pad sound that I created using a couple of synths, and it's just got this kind of slightly unnerving, slightly unresolved sound. It's not like a...
Sadly.
In musical terms, it's not like a major triad or a minor triad. It's sort of a bit of a seventh, and it's got a bit of a second in there, mm-hmm. and it's got a bit of sort of wavering pitch throughout it. But what I did was I actually sampled, once I created the patch, I then sampled it into an Akai sampler, which I've still got to this day. And the Akai samplers were renowned for having this amazing filter on it. So once I'd resampled it down to, I think, 12-bit maybe, it gives this really crunchy kind of sound to it. It's what all the drum bass guys used to use when Jungle and Drum Bass came in. They were all from Acolytes because it gave that grittiness that I was looking for. So even though the original sample of that sound that I made was kind of this slightly mellow, slightly unnerving, quite warm sounding pad, once I'd resampled it into the Akai, then you got the grit that I was looking for, and a little bit futuristic, because you introduce some aliasing in terms of the waveform when you run it through the Akai to do that kind of technique. So yeah, it was something that was quite an integral part of it, especially the whole front passage of that song.
No, that's really, really interesting, definitely. But then, like, Buck Fresh, of course, is a lot more classic in its sound. And that was going to lead me on to talk about the impact of sample CDs and how it did sort of, what would be the word, define a large part of music for a long time, like whether it be breaks and hip-hop for a while, but even pop, straight-up pop. You've mentioned yourself, like, some big vocal hooks just straight being taken from sample CDs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, back in the day, we're talking... I mean, here in the UK, specifically a company called Time and Space, who were, at that time, the main purveyors of sampling goodness, both on audio CD and whichever sampler you had, you could get them from that format. So in my case, Akai, and then they had Roland and Sonic formats and a few others as well. But companies would literally churn out this stuff, and I, to this day, don't know what the legalities were or are, because when I purchased all the sample CDs, it did say they were kind of 100% legitimate, blah, blah, blah. So my back's covered for my work, but I'm not sure about those companies themselves. But I mean, there's one, I think that, I mean, there was a company called Zero G who used to make a lot of them, and they were absolutely amazing. And I forget which disc, I think, I know it's volume two of, it's either Global Transmission or one of those Zero G. There's one you could hear, like, every dance track from the late 90s has a vocal hook from that, or a organ riff or a brass riff or something like that. So they had a massive impact, and I think got people into, you know, my sort of background with sampling goes more back to the early hip-hop days with discovering funk and that kind of thing. But I think people younger than me that were just getting into that kind of generation of sampling would have gone straight to one of those kind of CDs, and often back in those days you had a lot of cover mounted CDs which had samples on them. There was one I was actually asked to do a bunch of drum loops, so I programmed a whole load of drum loops for one of the sample CDs back in the time. So, you know, you used to spend your £7 whatever, and you'd have, like, you know, 100 drum loops and some vocal samples, and it meant, you know, young composers and producers and songwriters could start putting tracks together, you know, literally in their bedrooms. And that's where we saw the explosion of things like, you know, drum and bass and jungle, that was coming sort of hot off the heels of that kind of era.
And there was a Wild West quality to it, because one thing I wanted to bring up, just because I'm a huge fan, you mentioned being a big fan of The Prodigy, and they're probably, like, one of the most formative artists for me. They're sort of where it all started for me. I was a kid in the 90s, so it was just at the right time. But what that makes me think is, like, there's no way Liam Howlett was crediting every single sample he was using. So there was a sort of Wild Westy kind of quality.
Yeah, I mean, in those days, it really was the Wild West, because you had small independent record labels, you know, chucking out white labels for DJs to play in clubs on a Friday, Saturday night that wanted the new, hot, fresh stuff. And that was part of the culture, really. You know, what sample can I use? Oh, I like this really obscure drum break from a 1968, you know, band or something. And I think that kind of culture, you know, we call it digging for drum loops especially, and some vocal hooks as well, that was so prominent in the time where it was also a sort of slightly nostalgic part of the art form where, I was listening, when I was listening to, let's say, Public Enemy, for example, and then they would reference James Brown and things like that. And then, Liam from Prodigy would go back to, 60s, 70s, 80s records and just find out these amazing samples. And I think, I mean, I wouldn't want to speak to Liam, but he's definitely a huge pioneer of sampling and creating the Prodigy's very own distinctive sound. And I think it come. I know that he had a, I think he had a Roland W30, which is a sampling workstation, which a friend of mine had when I was at school. I went down the Akai route, but I know he was making some outstanding tracks on that. And a little anecdote for you, when I was doing my degree, it was actually in the town where they used to try out their set before going and playing in London. So I used to, there's this club called the Hippodrome, and on the top floor was a bar called God's Bar, and they used to play up there quite a lot. We're going back to just after Experience was released.
Oh,
So
that was incredible.
I was into them from the get-go, and saw them at Christmas in London, and the Christmas before in London. So I'm pretty sure Liam was studying classical music. I don't know whether he finished his course, but he's an incredibly talented musician and a great band.
And you can hear that in their work as well, with some of their really unusual chord changes and things like that. It's one of the reasons why I love them, for sure.
Yeah, same here.
Which, coming back, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that ties perfectly into a couple of questions I have about Mass Effect, where again, we've got this incredible mix of orchestral and rich, sounds to me to be analog synths, I imagine it is. But because you were working with Jack Wall, and I might mispronounce this, Sam Hulick?
Hulick, yep.
Hulick, I'm glad I got that right. I wasn't entirely sure like what parts of that you might be responsible for, or rather both, a little bit of both.
It's a good question. Jack called me up because the project was just so huge. There was a lot of music in that game. I forget how much, but I think it's in the region of 6 hours, and this is back in 2006, seven, I believe. So, we've got slightly bigger games these days, but in those days that was still quite big. So, we know that we needed, all hands on deck kind of thing. So I was working with Sam and Jack, and also David Cates came on board to score a lot of the cutscenes. My main role, what you'll probably know me of that project the best, is the first time you visit the Citadel, where the Normandy is sort of flying through the clouds, and you can just see this thing in the distance, and then the clouds part, and you see the Citadel in all its glory. That was quite a breakout piece for me that I scored. Then also, there's a piece called Becoming a Spectre, which is where you're in front of the council and you get presented with your medal, and you actually become a spectre. And I scored that as well, using a bit of one of Sam's themes. So we were kind of sharing themes amongst the composing team to make sure everything fitted together well. But I was doing mostly some of the earlier parts of the games, the game levels, and a lot of the cinematics, and also some of the choices where you have an interactive cutscene and you're making choices. I did a lot of the Benezia, I did some of the Ashley Caden choice. Trying to think now, some of the Liara portions, quite a lot of Saren. Yeah, so quite a lot in different places in the game. But yeah, the Citadel and Becoming a Spectre are some of the piece of music that I'm best known for in that franchise.
And I was going to ask how the collaboration plays out exactly, but I think you alluded to it there. Is it about sharing themes, or is it a more direct compositional collaboration?
It was more a question that each composer had their sort of main area of the game to work on, whether that be in-game gameplay, cinematics, choices, interactive narrative sections, things like that. But yeah, we sort of divvied it up. Jack was good at just kind of allocating who was doing what, making sure it was a manageable amount of work, making sure we were working together. So we would, discuss what's happening before this section that I'm scoring, and after, and our Sam might say, "Oh, I was scoring that section before your section." So we would make sure we were using similar sounds. So going back to one of your other points, we weren't actually using a lot of analog synths on this score. These were the kind of first incarnation of some of the really good analog plugins that we have
now. Yeah,
they
sound great.
Yeah, that was using a lot of the Arturia plugins, which were literally brand new at the time. So the Moog Modular, the CS80, the Jupiter 8, Mini Moog, those kind of plugins were literally off the shelf about 2 months before we started writing it. Mm-hmm. But that was actually good because we could program our own patches and just email the patch file to the other composers and they could use those in their sections. And again, that helped us fit it all together and make sure it was seamless throughout the score. So yeah, it was really good working that way. And yeah, pretty happy with the results as well.
Mm-hmm. And we can gladly get a bit musically geeky on here. We do quite often. And one thing I noticed listening through your work for Mass Effect is that it's got a lot of these big triumphant sci-fi chord changes. I'm a big sci-fi nut as well, so I recognise that and what was being gone for on those pieces. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the chord construction of building up something big that's going to get across that feeling of you're in a whole new magical wild place.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, especially on the Citadel cutscene, but I suppose to some degree, Becoming a Spectre, that sequence as well. I'm a massive fan of sort of big extended harmony. That is something I didn't necessarily study it, but I think going back to what I was saying about growing up and learning trombone, you know, when you're playing those kind of things in orchestras, you literally just absorb those kind of textures, those harmonies. And even though I can see what the other trombones sitting next to me are doing, I might be looking over at what the violas and cellos are doing or hearing a specific texture in the woodwind, you know, if I've got some bars rest in the trombone part. So it was a really invaluable experience just kind of being right in there, in a sense, rather than just studying a score, which, you know, which I was doing as well, but actually being inside a symphony, if you see what I mean, and being part of it, that it was an amazing learning experience. And I think when it comes to those kind of big chord changes, whether it's something deliberate to sound magical or to make an impact or to have a complete change, that was something I purposely wanted to do on Mass Effect, especially in the Citadel cutscene, because it was such a shift seeing the Citadel for the first time, and it's such a great cinematic. You know, the artist did an absolutely incredible job, because you don't realise the magnitude of this space station until you see it, and then you know that great shot when it appears through the clouds and the sort of sun comes out. And I wanted to really highlight that and take it to a different place harmonically, so it does go completely, you know, to a completely different chord that you just don't see coming. And when you utilize those things in composition, that can really elevate the player's experience.
100%. But arguably not much franchise wise has a stronger harmonic character than something like Bond. It's so very established, the music of Bond. And I am a huge fan. I really am. I actually can't put it into words what a big fan I am. So I have to start out with how amazing it was to me to read about a demo you put together to try and help get yourself the job pushing for a British composer, which I think rightly so in this case. So you went all out on a demo and got some actual movie players on this. So let me make sure I actually get the name 100% right. Derek Watkins, for example, played on Doctor No.
Correct.
So you can't get more authentic than that. So if you could talk a little bit about the construction of this demo, even before we get into the actual meat of the soundtrack itself.
Sure. Well, I was called up by Bizarre Creations, who I'd worked with previously on a bunch of games, Metropolis Street Racer, The Club, probably something else that I've forgotten, but I already knew the team at Bizarre, and they said they were, you know, they've got the license and they were going to be making this game. Would I like to demo for it? Because they would love me to do the score. And I said, absolutely. And I remember I was in Germany at the time doing a couple of concerts, and I immediately picked up the phone to my good friend Steve Wimmett in Arizona, who's an incredible virtuoso guitarist. He did a lot of the re-records on the Guitar Hero games. And very nice guy. So I said, right, Steve, you're playing the theme, the James Bond theme, which coincidentally they hadn't asked me to do as part of the demo, but I thought we've got to demonstrate that we can do that. So Steve went out and spoke to some people in the States and got hold of a, I think it was a 1952 Silvertone guitar, if I remember rightly. I'm not really a guitarist myself, but I believe that's what he managed to secure, because that would have been sort of accurate for the re-recording of the James Bond theme. And then the developer wanted all the composers. I think there were probably about 8 or 10 in the running, as far as I know. I think there's one other British composer and some American composers. And they wanted us to write a piece of music for a puzzle type scenario and an action sort of gunfight type scenario. So I write both of those pieces, got the James Bond theme arranged, and I thought, well, this is really, you can't really make this music on computer, you know, those kind of players and that playing style just doesn't exist in sample libraries, and it would sound horrible. So yeah, I did take a bit of a gamble, but I think it showed my passion and enthusiasm for the project and my understanding of that kind of style of writing, especially for the brass. You know, if you don't know how to write that kind of those lines and those styles for especially the trumpets, but to some degree the horns as well, I wanted to get that across. So I did decide to hire all the A-list musicians and go to Abbey Road and record my demo there, which is exactly what I did. And yeah, we had, I think the trumpet section was exactly off the previous Bond film at the time, exactly the same people. And out of the whole of the brass section, we had 6 French horns, 5 of which were principals in LSO, LPO, Scottish National, Royal Welsh. I mean, these are just incredible players, and you know, throughout the brass community, they've sort of heard about this session and they said, oh, how did you put that together? And I just said, well, I know a lot of the players and sort of spoke to a lot of them and handpicked them and had a friend of mine helping out with the contracts. And you know, you want that sound, you go to the players that make that sound. And if you get the writing, you know, right, like you said, it is a very stylistic type of sound, that kind of Bond sound. But yeah, I had an amazing time recording the demos, and the producer and the lead designer came down and told me the good news soon after I submitted my demos.
Yeah, it's got to be a bit of a dream job for sure. but it brings me back to brass technique again, because I played cornet very briefly. I wish that I stuck it out more, but I didn't in the end. But I know enough to know how absolutely difficult brass instruments are to play and how many different techniques there are out there. I loved what you mentioned in a previous interview about Derek Watkins, this very authentic player, adding a whole octave above what you'd initially composed, and that being amazing. And again, I know from my short time with Cornet how hard it is to reach those high notes. So to maybe some people who don't have the background of playing trombone as early as you do, what are some of the things you can do to bring brass more alive, particularly with something like Bond, where it's so trilly, it's almost deliberately straining sometimes during some of the action sequences?
Yeah, I mean, specifically in the trumpet writing for Bond, it's all about the high notes. So you have to get a player that is, we would technically call a screamer, someone who's a high note specialist, because that can be very different from a regular kind of symphonic player. But having that range and that ability and that sheer power of the diaphragm and the airflow through the instrument is what enables those kind of players to play really, really high. And Derek was one of definitely the highest players around. I mean, yeah, he did put another octave on the top of stuff I'd already written, which was already higher than a normal trumpet can play. So it was pretty outstanding. And then when if you sort of understand how the harmonics of a brass instrument work, and in terms of the harmonic series, you sort of know that the notes get closer together the higher you play. So even though, you know, the trumpets have vowels and the trombone has a slide, if you understand that, then you can actually almost play in between them, and that's what some of these amazing trumpet players were able to do. So you almost get kind of one line, this beautiful lyrical line, even though they're screaming up the top, sort of playing a melody. There might be 5 or 6 notes, but it's kind of It's almost like sort of, it has a sort of singing quality to it, but it's really loud and really high. And when they're screaming on top of like some really percussive action scoring with the strings and the percussion, that's part of that sound. And you know, like you said, you've got other effects, you know, you've got like flutter tongue, you've got all the use of all the different mutes, which was utilized a lot in the Bloodstone score, especially the plunger mute. That's quite a big, gives that kind of a slightly wah-wah sound for the trumpets and trombones. Mm-hmm. And then the horns, you know, specifically on Bond, I wrote quite low for the horns. So again, we had a couple of low specialists because the French horns have a quite broad range of the instrument, and in Guardians as well, I wrote quite low, and it gives this really beautiful, sort of slightly dirty, low, muddy quality, rather than the kind of very straight sound you can get out of the horns when a lot higher. So, yeah, it's knowing the instruments well and knowing what they can do, and also being respectful to the players because they're playing their socks off, and you know, give them an extra break or ask them how their embouchure's doing, and you know, do you need a 5-minute break here, and you know, because they really are cranking hard on the performance, but you know, it just shows in that score. I think it really shows.
And speaking of technique, leading back into Guardians, I know you did a lot of work with the choir on that, and I saw this very brief video footage from Abbey Road itself, I think, which was you talking about particularly strange guttural and whispering sounds and things like that. I'm really beginning to get playful with the choir, which I'm sure you've worked with plenty in the past. If you could talk a little bit about that process and how you figure those things out.
Yeah, it was, so the use of the choir and the choral effects were for two specific segments of the game. So one is earlier on the game where you meet a character called Lady Hellbender, who's this kind of very tall, slightly butch looking monster collector, I think is a hobby. And I wanted to have, you know, retain her femininity, but also this really strong personality that she has. And if you look at some of the monsters that she's got collected in her throne room, I guess you could call it, you know, you can really tell that she's totally badass. So I wanted some sort of slightly new elements that people wouldn't have heard. And the whispering idea came to me when I was scoring a scene as the Guardians are first going towards a throne room, and I thought I wanted to build the tension, and I was sort of messing around with these sort of phonetics, and they're actually derived from Kree, which is one of the languages in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and one of the races. So you do have a lot of consonants and they're quite throaty sounds. So even though they're completely unpitched, just having the choir whispering very loudly, it's a kind of juxtaposition because it's still a whispering texture, but all the consonants are quite throaty and guttural, and they do give a lot of impact. And that seemed to work really well. And I did some tests while I was scoring it, just using my own voice and tracking lots of times on my Pro Tools rig. And then I wanted to also have a chant for Lady Hellbender. So both the male and females in the choir, we recorded the whispering and then the chant, which is just a sort of, and then put those together. And that's kind of the essence of Lady Hellbender's sound. And then we bring the orchestra on top and emphasize the motif. And yeah, it's quite a chromatic, quite a dark sort of motif for her. But then also in the other section was in the Universal Church of Truth, which is a big part of the game. I won't give any spoilers away in case people haven't had the opportunity to play it, but it's chapter 8. And there's a segment that also uses another chant for a different reason, but that's all I'm going to say in case I spoil it.
Well, that's perfect, because I was going to ask, because I know that you've mentioned before about how much you do like to think about narrative with the music and really servicing the narrative with your music too. Excuse me. And getting deep into that. And you've already talked a lot about that there, about the character of Lady Hellbender there. But could you talk a little bit more broadly about what it's like to maybe work with some of the writers as well, and maybe if it's actually shifting and changing throughout the production?
Yeah, sure. Well, you're absolutely right. I do dig very, very deep into the story and the characters, and having the amazing opportunity to work on an IP such as Guardians of the Galaxy and all the Marvel lore that comes with that, it was like a smorgasbord of delights that I was able to choose from. So another example is when there's another level where you're fighting one of Lady Hellbender's monsters, who's this gigantic thing with eight legs or something. And there's a bit in the choir, and the choir is sort of basically there for sort of effect. They're backing up what the orchestra is doing. The orchestra is going crazy. It's like a boss fight, really. And I was thinking of lyrics to get the choir. I mean, we use a lot of Italian and made up and loads of different kind of techniques when we're doing action scoring as a composer, but the actual phonetics in that part of the choir, a lot of them are singing Destro Mundo, which is the name of Lady Hellbender's ship from the comics. Mm-hmm. So putting a few things in there for the fans as well, whether it's too subtle or not, I don't know, but it was fun to kind of tie that together with the character. Not that you really see her spaceship in the game, but I looked at the comics where that comes from. But also on the narrative side, yeah, I mean, working with the narrative designers and the script writers is one of the first things I do to really get under the skin of what they're doing and putting into the story arc. And I like to explore the narrative from the beginning so that I know high points, low points, emotional points, action points. And it already gives the score a shape, and it's a shape that I think is really important to try and stick to, so that I'm supporting the narrative, but I'm not dictating it to the player. It's up to the player to find it out themselves. One of the most poignant scenes in Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy was when Star-Lord meets Drax overlooking the rift. It's in nowhere, I think chapter 6 or 7 perhaps. And it's sort of a side conversation, and some people have never even come across it in the game. But when you do have that conversation, again, I won't give anything away, but it's quite a deep emotional conversation that Drax and Star-Lord have. And I wanted to make sure the music reacted to that. So it's a branching conversation. So what that means is the player gets a choice every couple of sentences, and there's a whole load of different branches to that narrative segment that can go either way. And it has lots of strands of music, but to get that, get the emotional beat right, I had to create maybe 30 or 40 different segments and make sure they all work seamlessly together. And luckily we managed to achieve that, and I did have a lot of emails and DMs from people saying, you know, that scene they were crying, and they felt so emotional, things like that. And so that's sort of job done from the composer's point of view, I think. And yeah, it was a joy to go into those depths and work so closely with the narrative team, to be honest.
Yeah, it really makes a difference, because without caring about things like that, you're already going to be sounding so much more stock, I think, you know, just like an orchestra in the background, you know, rather than something that's meant for it.
I mean, I'm not interested in sounding stock, and also if there's no reason to do it emotionally, then, you know, what is the composer trying to achieve? I mean, you know, some of the stuff in Guardians is a massive orchestra and choir, and some of it is really scaled down, and some bits a few synth pads and things like that. So I think it does have the range that I was looking to get out of it. And yeah, I mean, I did really go deep on that one, and I think it hopefully shows, because I didn't want it to be a kind of generic score, and I don't think it is.
No, definitely not. And as we hit the hour mark, I'm left with only about 2 questions, but just want to make sure you're all right with that.
Yep, fine.
I mean, because also talking about making sure that this is something that works for the project, is something definitively for that project. One thing we haven't talked about at all, and it's important for game music, is interactivity and the dynamic side of it. And this kind of peels back to James Bond a little bit, because there was one thing you were talking about not wanting to do it the standard ways necessarily anymore, of having the stealth and the action layers that jump between them in the ways that we've had for years. I thought this was really insightful because as a gamer, the more that's gone on, the more that has become stock, the more it can actually take you out of the game and remind me, oh yeah, this is a game, because it's doing the game things of what dynamic music has set up over the past 10 years. And you were talking about trying to do things in a different way, and specifically about building tension in one scene of James Bond as you move through it. What are some ways you feel like we can approach dynamic music in a more interesting way?
I think, yeah, everyone's got their own approach. I don't think we're at the stage where there's right and wrong anymore, which I think is a good thing. I think this becomes part of being a composer working in video games and having the experience of games and how they are made and constructed. As a composer, it gives me an advantage because I can also design the music system as well. Sometimes I'm not necessarily a C++ coder or C# coder, but I know enough to work with the coding team or the middleware tools that I might be using. But instead of an audio director saying, oh yes, piece of stealth music here, piece of action music here, and I think, well, I think we can do better than that. I think we can go deeper into what those two tracks are going to provide. So the example that I think you're probably referring to is, it's a scene where Bond is, as the character, is going through this building. It's in a yacht club, and there's a gunfight that breaks out. And when I was playing it for the first time with a few of the gun sounds in and a few of the temporary voices but no music, I was thinking, well, is it primarily a gunfight sequence, or is it primarily a sort of stealthing through the building sequence? And I played it through a few times and I sort of realized it's mostly a gunfight, but the stealth element is kind of 60-40, so 60 in the gunfight favors. And I thought, well, we can't just have a stealth track and then we can't just keep switching to an action track or a gunfight track. It's just going to sound ridiculous. And I, as a gamer, I've always been bored of those kind of things. Oh, that's the action, that's the stealth. It's informing the player too much, and it doesn't sound very good. And I know that's all we could do back in the days of the Mega Drive, things like that, play action music, play stealth music, but we're way ahead of that now, technically. So the way I approached that was to have... And this is only for one section of the game. I approach every bit of the game in a different way depending on what the content is. But for that section in the yacht club, yes, there's a whole gunfight layer, but there's about six other layers of music underneath which we can switch and crossfade to, which goes very seamlessly into stealth mode over the course of about 6 seconds, if memory serves me correctly. It does depend on how many enemies are around, depending on when you're proximity to another room, things like that. But I was looking at lots and lots of different elements, number of enemies, class of enemies, you know, were they just some waiter or were they one of the henchmen you're looking for? What's in the next room? What's the environment of the next room? How close are we to it? Things like that. Have we got narrow corridors? Have we got big open plan sections? And all those things help form my opinion of how I'm going to approach that particular scene or that particular section of gameplay. And in Bloodstone, that we use so many different techniques throughout the game. That was just one of them. But it, I'm a massive Bond fan like yourself, and I wanted that to have that seamless experience for the player. Even though it's a game, I still wanted to give them that sense of they are Bond, they are in that experience. In the movie, if you like, and that's how I would score it if it was a piece of linear film. So trying to do that interactively is quite complex, and it takes a lot of iterations and working closely with the programmers. But yeah, it's definitely worth it in my opinion. I always try and look at it in terms of how I want a scene to be played out as the game. I put myself in the gamer's shoes, and then how do I think this is going to work the best? And then we figure out the technical things. I don't believe technical should inform creative and musical things. I'm really not a fan of that. I don't think it gives good results. So, I'm always willing to go the extra mile with the developer who I'm working with. I say, look, no, we can do it like this. This is how we do it, and it'll give better results, and it might take me twice or three times as long, but it's always worth the extra graft, I think. It makes a big difference in the gaming experience.
And yeah, that really speaks to exactly why game composing is so much its own industry. It's not just composing for film or simply transferred to a game. And I know you've very much been a champion of that over your life. So for my very final question, it was kind of interesting to me because I usually like to ask about how composers might feel like the industry has changed in their career. And a lot of the time I get back things like, well, we were trapped on synths for so long, and I've now got access to orchestras. I've now got access to Abbey Road in some cases. But quite early on in your career, you were working out of Abbey Road, and working with big orchestral players. So I feel like that's not necessarily going to be a change for you. So what changes have you noticed in your career in game music?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, for me personally, I've always tried to push the boundaries of the industry, and I've tried to, in my own way, bring everyone along with me and bring the industry kind of along, because at the end of the day, it's about the quality of music. And if you're going to get a really great orchestra, a really great studio, and yes, of course, there's a budget involved there, it needs to stand up on its own 2 feet and create those results. And I knew it would for Headhunter, and I'm fortunate enough to have my signed Guardians poster up in Abbey Road in the corridor at the moment, which is a real honor. But it's just really trying to sort of make the industry see what's possible creatively, and don't look at the sort of the corporate side of it or the technical side of it. And like you said, we've hardly got any limitations now. I mean, I don't feel limited in terms of technology, in terms of working with live orchestras and choirs, and I've got a nice big collection of analog synths myself now. Things that drive me are story, being honest, story and characters, and also people I work with, meeting like-minded people that are willing to go the extra mile and not looking at the clock and not saying we can't do this or we can't afford to do this. Once I've sort of made my case, like we were just talking about with Interactivity and on the Bloodstone soundtrack, that is kind of who I am as a composer and as a person, and I will always be like that and try and strive to deliver excellence. And I don't believe in no, I don't believe in people saying no. I would always try and find a way to make things literally as good as they can be, even when working within constraints. I think the industry, it's grown, it's huge now. It's some good things about that, some not so good. But in general, I think last year was a very tough year in the industry with lots of layoffs and kind of industry, I wouldn't say contraction, but I've never really known it like that. And as a gamer myself, I'm just wanting more big narrative-driven games that I can play and that I can hopefully work on as well. So I think it's all good. We're going in the right direction. It's good to see new talent coming in. It's good to see some great female composers coming into the industry. A lot of them friends of mine, and glad to see they're getting recognized. And also the general sort of opinion and recognition of what game music is. I think you're right when you mentioned that it is so different from film and TV, and they all have their challenges just like we do. I'm not saying one's easier or harder, they're just different beasts really. But I think it's the challenge of video games that is what attracts me to the medium so much. So hopefully that will never cease to be the case.
Yeah, and it's just one final point. I mean, coming down to things like the 25th anniversary of Jet Set Radio release and everything like that, like it's been released and listened to a lot more than it was back in, say, 2000 as well. Now, being respected as an art form to actually listen to away from the game as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when things take a life on their own. Quite a lot of stuff I've worked on, especially some of my earlier work, has taken a life of its own out, away from the game. And, people that weren't even born when I was writing that now just love it for the music or for a particular song or a particular track. And I think it's amazing that, that's what the internet has certainly helped with by enabling people just to hear these tracks. And, could be from any game, from any composer. They just really like the game music scene. I think that's a really positive thing. And for Jet Set Radio, it's itself, it's amazing for me to know that people are still listening to that now, 25 years on. It's quite humbling in a way, and I still have amazing respect for that game and for all the the other artists and musicians and the people that made that, because I think it is truly iconic, and I think it stands up today incredibly well. And yeah, it's been really cool to see all the things online about the celebration of the anniversary, and it's just great that people are still listening.
Absolutely. And I think and hope people are going to really enjoy this conversation, Richard, because you've really brought it. And thank you so much for this conversation.
Hi, you're very welcome. And yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's been great to chat all things game music. So thanks for having me.